This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, September 6th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's show, the Dairy Arts Center will hold a special in-person event tomorrow with filmmaker Johanna Lunn. She'll join us live in the studio this morning. This Week in Water, we'll examine life-threatening floods from Pakistan to Jackson, Mississippi. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines, and then it's How on Earth? Today's episode of the KGNU Science Show features CU Medical School professor Rick Johnson, author of the new book, Nature Wants Us to Be Fat. At 9 a.m. comes Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker, known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, James Wise will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's James Swenson.
The heat wave that scorched Labor Day vacationers this weekend will continue throughout most of the week, with highs into the triple digits and mid-90s for most of Denver metro area. The dry heat is expected to ease on Friday, with the cold front moving in over the weekend. Officials announced an air quality alert yesterday through 12 p.m. today. They recommend that because of high levels of ozone, sensitive groups, including those with asthma or lung disease, avoid the outdoors. The city of Boulder is planning on opening a new day services center for unhoused residents. Backed by the city council, the goal is to create a shelter to improve the general health and well-being of people who might use the space, while also improving the public areas where people experiencing unsheltered homelessness reside. The Daily Camera reports that the city of Boulder would like to provide a single location where people can connect with organizations that provide services like case management and mental health support. But as with many projects related to homelessness, there is disagreement in the community about the shelter, including where to locate it, what services it should provide, and whether it's a good idea at all. Boulder hasn't offered daytime shelter services since the service provided by organizations Bridge House and Boulder Outreach for Homeless Overflow ended in 2017. Boulder is also preparing to kick off its Project Recovery, which will provide residential and outpatient services for people with significant substance use disorders, as well as the Building Home Project, which will improve housing retention for people within permanent supportive housing.
Thornton police fatally shot a man who jumped into oncoming traffic Monday morning after the man, according to reports, showed a weapon to law enforcement. Louis LeCon reports.
Police closed north and southbound lanes on I-25 between Thornton Parkway and 84th Avenue for several hours Monday morning after a man on the road was nearly hit by several incoming vehicles. When police arrived at the scene, a report says that officers shot and killed a man after he produced a weapon. The identity of the man has not yet been released, but police officers involved in the shooting were placed on administrative leave while the 17th Judicial District Critical Incident Team investigates the situation. For KGNU, I am Luis Licon.
This spring, the Boulder Valley School District will screen every kindergartner in the district after piloting the program for 2 years in select schools. These programs hope to help teachers tailor curriculums to students who may have different learning styles. The screening will help identify students that are struggling with speech sounds, decoding words, and spelling. These efforts come after the state continues its own program for dyslexia screening. According to the Department of Education, 15 to 20% of the population is affected by dyslexia. Boulder Valley is one of the first Colorado districts to implement dyslexia screening. Today's highs will reach the upper 90s with a low around 65, mostly sunny and continued very warm throughout the week. For KGNU, I'm James Swenson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Tomorrow, the Dairy Arts Center in Boulder will host a screening of the first two parts of the When You Die documentary trilogy. Filmmaker Johanna Lunn will host a live Q&A after the screening, but she's with me now, live in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start off with a spoiler you shared with us. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal event. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, if you're born into this life, and since we're talking, we both obviously have been, we will die. There is no escaping that.
tell us about the event you'll be hosting tomorrow at the Dairy Arts Center. Doors open at 5:30, but tell us what the substance is.
Okay, yeah. Doors do open at 5:30 and screening starts at 6. I'm so excited to be here with this. This is a never seen before first two chapters or episodes of the When You Die trilogy. And really, this we are doing a slow rollout of the trilogy. The third episode doesn't drop until early next year. So this is our first time to share the first episode, which is In the Realm of Death and Dreaming, which asks the big question, does consciousness continue after death? And we explore that from a scientific point of view, experiential points of view, and we let viewers, of course, make their own decisions. I'm not here to tell anybody what to think or do. The second one is called Saying Goodbye, Preparing for Death. And that's really sorting through, if you know what you believe happens after you die, then how do you want to be cared for at the end of your life? And how do we have a conversation around those things with friends and relatives when none of us really want to talk about death?
And exactly. I mean, and why is it important? None of us do want to talk about it, but all of us will experience it. So why is it important to talk about death and dying?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it is certainly at the heart of this project, because you don't want to wait until the 11th hour when there's an emergency. Someone's in the hospital. They're taking their last breaths. And what do you want? Are you an organ donor? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want extraordinary measures to stay alive? You know, what quality of life is enough for you? All the things that you never said to the person who's dying, and all the things they never got to say to you. You know, there's so much unresolved life that's happening when you don't think these things through, when you don't know what you want. And so the journey, you know, to die can be much more kind and compassionate and eased if all of those things are figured out in advance and you don't have to sweat the small stuff, big stuff at the end.
How common do you find it that people figure out what they want and communicate it well in advance? How common is that?
It's not very common. It's not very common. We've got a real death-defying culture, and it really kicked in after World War II when the living room was not the living room. The living room was the parlor. And
yes,
that's where bodies were laid out. Mm-hmm. So I know in my grandmother's house, babies were born there and people died there. And everything happened within the context of the family home. So women knew the signs and marks of approaching birth, and they also knew the signs and marks of approaching death. So we have lost all of that. With World War II and so much death and so much trauma, unresolved trauma, probably to the end for most of those soldiers, Better Homes and Gardens rebranded the parlor as the living room. And the rise of the funeral service, you know, the funeral parlor, kicked in. And so we moved death out of our homes, and then we continued to move suffering and pain further and further and further away. And it became really a taboo subject, so that even for a school-aged child who has lost a parent, teachers, family members, friends have no idea how to deal with those kinds of traumas. So we really want to normalize the conversation around death, to bring, you know, this inevitable thing that's happening every single day into our lives as part of our lives, so that we really live more fully and completely.
And of course, this is part of a documentary trilogy, which documentaries always involve speaking to lots of people. Who all did you interview for this?
Well, for the whole project, I should say this started out as one film about 8 years ago. And I thought, okay, you know, indie film, 3 years, we'll be done, pop it out. And as I really started researching this, I found how rich this whole area was. Not even just the issue of what is it to be a human and does consciousness continue, but everything from grief journeys to how we die, that the body knows how to die, that, you know, we get in the way and often block the natural process of death, and all how family relationships change, and all, it just was so huge that one film became three, and there'll probably an epilogue somewhere in the doorway there. So that was, and that also gave birth to the When You Die Project, which isn't just this suite of films. We have a really rich website, a podcast, you know, a whole bunch of things out there on social media. So it's taken on a life of its own. So it was way more than I ever imagined it would be, but it's also way more rewarding than I ever thought it would be.
When I was conversing with your associate producer to schedule this interview, she said something that stuck with me, and it's that Boulder has a strong death positive community. What do you think she meant by that?
Yeah, well, and I think we're talking Boulder County overall. Well, even just here in Boulder, it houses a number of hospices, a lot of home services that work end of life, with the first one being, I think it was called Donna Home Care, which started in the late 70s. And that was a really groundbreaking thing to bring companions for end of life into the home. Today, we would say they're like death doulas, not just like visiting nurses, but companions to be with you and to help take care of your home and so on. So no one dies alone. Then there's the Institute for Conscious Dying, which is an online training, doula training program, death doulas. There is, I believe, through Naropa University, there is a chaplaincy program. I'm not sure what's at CU, but I'm quite certain there's probably things there as well. So I know there's a very active community. Oh, and plus, Judy's House in Longmont, which works with it's a grief support unit for families and children. And they do training all over North America. And they also do professional ongoing training to help people working as counselors and so on in the best practices with grief care for children. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. I know there's a lot more going on here. So it's quite rich. And also, you know, this is a county that there's a significant young population, but there's also a reasonably large elder population, 60 plus. And then you've got the sandwich group. If you're not aging yourself, you're likely taking care of a parent who is. So,
and a lot of the sandwich group here is not present because it's so expensive to raise kids in Boulder.
That's true.
Yeah. So a lot of them are not here present with perhaps their parents who are still in Boulder, but they've had to go elsewhere. Johanna Lund, we are in our final minute. I just want to ask you, you say it's important to have a sense of humor about death. Why is that?
Well, they did a study that said they looked at people who grew up in homes where death was taboo and never spoken about, and another where people grew up in a home where death was part of everyday life. And the group who grew up with death as part of everyday life actually had a really good sense of humor as opposed to the other repressed group.
Yeah. Well, my guest today has been Johanna Lund. She is the filmmaker behind the When You Die documentary trilogy. She'll be hosting a live Q&A after the screening of the first two of her three parts of that film. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.
For our Kalmekak, the Sikhs and Kalmekak, what we do is our mission is to heal ourselves and our communities through the ancestral knowledge of the earth. And with that, looking at seeing, learning and growing and healing from an indigenous perspective, when we say healing in that way, we don't mean just ourselves. But when we heal ourselves, we heal our ancestors and we heal our descendants and we heal our community.
For more of this Chicana and Indigenous wisdom, please tune into Hemispheres this evening at 6 p.m. to hear Deborah Montoya, Renee Millard Chacon, and Micaela Ironcloud Dominguez. That's Tuesday, 6 p.m. on Hemispheres.
Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Powering your car with a lobster. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Another wake-up call is sounding. Will the world continue sleepwalking? That's the warning of UN Secretary Antonio Guterres, who said, today it's Pakistan, but tomorrow it could be your country.
Pakistan has suffered devastating flooding, with one-third of the country underwater. Over 1,200 people have died, and more than 1 million homes are gone.
Along parts of the country's largest river, the Indus, plains areas have been turned into seas after some districts received 5 times the average rainfall during July and August.
The links to climate change are apparent. A warmer atmosphere and rising sea temperatures lead to more evaporation. Because the air holds more water, it can result in the intense monsoons that Pakistan has suffered.
Making matters worse, Pakistan has 7,000 glaciers, the most outside polar regions, and recent extreme heat caused lakes to form, which then burst.
The World Health Organization warns that the crisis is aggravating malnutrition and causing outbreaks of malaria, diarrhea, polio, and other diseases.
The current emergency in Jackson, Mississippi, the state's capital, where tens of thousands have been without clean water, shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. Residents of the city and local officials have been warning of the problem for years.
People in Jackson, which is over 80% black, lack water for drinking, cooking, bathing, and flushing toilets after flooding from heavy rains exacerbated problems at already struggling water plants.
Because of the crisis, schools switched to virtual classes, and for now, the National Guard has been deployed to distribution sites where long lines of cars wait to pick up plastic water bottles, many of which are ending up on streets or going to landfills.
A student at Jackson State University told NBC that he was hospitalized after showering, and a doctor had told him he'd been exposed to bacteria. One resident told the Washington Post that he hadn't had running water for about a year and a half. Customers still have to keep paying their bills, even though they can't use the water.
The city has old and leaking pipes, malfunctions at treatment plants, and not enough money to fix them. Residents and activists accuse Mississippi's Republican-controlled and largely white legislature of repeatedly thwarting efforts to upgrade Jackson's sewer and water systems.
The legislature has passed a bill that would fund nearly $500 million for infrastructure, short of the $2 billion the city needs, but it requires Jackson to come up with matching dollars when it only has about 5%.
Once water pressure is restored to Jackson, there are worries the aging and brittle pipes will burst.
The world is transitioning to a greener future as more renewable energy sources like wind and solar come online and demand for electric vehicles increases.
Unfortunately, much clean tech relies on batteries that currently are not sustainably sourced and can't be recycled, which is the case for lithium mining that can have a significant environmental and social cost.
But a sustainable solution could be at your favorite seafood restaurant. Researchers at the University of Maryland are using a fiber called chitosan from lobsters, shrimp, and crab shell waste as an electrolyte in a zinc-based rechargeable battery.
Electrolytes are liquids or gels that move charged molecules or ions between the positive and negative sides of a battery. A chitosan electrolyte biodegrades in months and leaves behind the metal component, in this case zinc, which can be easily recycled.
The study's authors said that after 400 hours, their prototype remained energy efficient. So one day, shrimp could help store energy from wind and solar, or a lobster shell could run your car. And finally, staples like corn, wheat, and rice have sustained people for centuries, but global warming is putting those crops at risk as rising temperatures, extreme weather events, and droughts affect yields.
There is, however, a climate-proof food that might be arriving on your dinner plate, and perhaps one you've never heard of, breadfruit.
Sometimes called a tree potato for its starchy consistency, breadfruit can be as big as a melon and are native to the South Pacific, where for thousands of years they've been steamed, fried, roasted, and even made into flour.
They're a good source of protein, fiber, vitamins, and minerals. The trees can withstand heat and drought and don't require much maintenance. Also, unlike crops that need to be replanted every year, breadfruit trees hum along, sequestering carbon over their lifetime.
Given these superpowers, researchers at Northwestern University wanted to know, would climate change eventually come for the breadfruit tree?
Probably not. The trees are resilient. The teams modeled two potential climate scenarios for the future and found that suitable areas for growing breadfruit would decrease by only around 4%.
And they also found that new growing areas might open up, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, which could supply a stable food source for that region.
Breadfruit trees provide more than food security. They can improve soils and watersheds and give shelter to bees, birds, and bats.
Between the crab-based batteries and breadfruit, it sounds like sustainability is on the menu.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and the listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU.
We love Music Amunde when Mariah used to do it, and we've listened and listened, and Mariah doesn't seem to be doing that any longer. But if you could tell me if Mariah is doing a show of music anymore, and when, I would certainly appreciate it. We're listening to the other people that are doing it, and quite honestly, they're pretty bad. So, what happened to Mariah? Can you tell us when we could hear her?
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25. That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to James Swenson, Luis Licon, Steve Miller, Alexis Kenyon, Rosanna Longo-Better, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up just after the news headlines from the BBC.
BBC News with Danielle Jawowiecka. Liz Truss has been appointed Britain's new Prime Minister, ending a two-month transition that began when scandal forced the resignation of her predecessor Boris Johnson. Ms Truss takes office at a time of severe economic problems at home and war in Europe. The BBC understands her first act will be to freeze gas and electricity bills for households. The European Commission is proposing to suspend measures that make it easier for Russians to obtain visas. It said this should continue as long as Moscow waged its war of aggression against Ukraine. The Commission proposes that Russians wanting to enter the EU should face a lengthier and more expensive application process, and that multiple entry visas should be restricted. US media reports suggest that Russia is buying large quantities of rockets and artillery shells from North Korea for use in the war in Ukraine. US intelligence is said to believe that this is down to severe shortages facing Russia's military. Pakistani authorities are struggling to stop the country's biggest lake from bursting its banks after frantic attempts to lower water levels failed. Dikes have been deliberately breached to relieve pressure on Munchur Lake in Sindh province, which is reeling under floods. An official in Iran says that what was once the largest lake in the Middle East could dry up if an emergency plan is not implemented. Lake Urmia has been shrinking for years because of drought, heat and dam building. Yemeni security sources say an attack by al-Qaeda has left 21 fighters allied to the government dead. Six members of al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen were also killed during clashes that lasted for several hours in Abyan Governorate in southern Yemen. Rescuers in Russia have managed to bring down three people who've been trapped high on the slopes of an active volcano in the country's far east. Previous efforts were thwarted by bad weather. BBC News.
This program is made possible by you, the KGNU listener member, and by Fisk Planetarium on the CU Boulder campus, providing innovative astronomy, science, and artistic programs since 1975. More information at colorado.edu/Fisk or by calling 303-492-5002.
I'm Shelley Schlender. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, September 6th, 2022. Coming up, we talk with CU Medical Professor Rick Johnson about why nature wants us to be fat.
Please don't hear this talk and go, oh my God, I can't eat anything that's good, because it's not true. It's the problem of eating some foods that are really bad, like liquid sugar is really bad. Once you understand the mechanism, you can actually figure out the best way to avoid activating the switch and giving you back your health.
It's September, when bears fatten up for the harsh winter up ahead. Colorado Medical School professor Richard Johnson says bears do this because they eat fruit and berries that are filled with a sugar known as fructose. Johnson says fructose triggers a survival switch that drives bears to gorge and gain weight so they can survive a winter of hibernation. How does this work for people? Johnson believes modern Western foods can push our survival switches into overdrive. Johnson explains all this in his latest book, Nature Wants Us to Be Fat, and he warns it's not just fructose that triggers this switch. Here's CU Medical Professor Rick Johnson.
You know, fructose or sugar is the primary driver of obesity. Sugar or high fructose corn syrup make up about 15% of our diet. Children, adolescents, and also disadvantaged populations are often eating a higher percentage of sugar. So that is your number one.